Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to walk in space and to be given the job of repairing the world's most famous tool for unlocking the mysteries of deep space? Mike Massimino was accepted as an astronaut candidate by NASA in 1996 and spent nearly 6 years in training before he took his first space flight on Shuttle Columbia. On that trip, he spent nearly 15 hours outside the shuttle working on the Hubble Space Telescope. 2 years ago, Massimino returned to space on Shuttle Atlantis for the final planned maintenance mission for Hubble to install new equipment and make repairs expected to keep the telescope in good working order through 2014. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
At what stage in your career did you say, okay, I really want to try for the space program?
Well, it kind of went in two phases. When I was very young, when I was 6 years old, is when I watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. And I remember the events leading up to that, the other Apollo missions leading up, Apollo 10 and Apollo 11, of course, was the landing, really caught my imagination. I dressed up as an astronaut for Halloween.
But like right you and 50 that. Million other American kids, right?
I guess, but it really made an impression. It was 1969. I'm from New York, so the Mets also won the World Series that year. And that kind of said, you know, miracles happened in 1969. We walked on the moon, and the Mets won the World Series. But that really did catch my attention. It never really left me as being something that was really cool. And I idolized the astronauts. You know, they were my heroes. And as I got older and went through high school, I didn't know what I, you know, I liked math and science, but I didn't know what I was going to do. And didn't think much about what job I might have. And it really wasn't until after I got out of college and I started working. And I was thinking, well, what do you really want to do with your life? I liked math and science, so I studied engineering. But once I got out of college, I started thinking about it. And I was very interested in what NASA was doing. The shuttle program was getting started. And I thought, well, maybe I could do something. You know, mm-hmm. I had an engineering job. And the greatest thing would be to be an astronaut. But if that doesn't happen, I could still contribute some way. So I decided after working a couple of years to go to grad school. And I went to grad school up at MIT, which is kind of like if you want to be an actor or an actress, I guess you go to Hollywood.
Right.
So, like, MIT was kind of a normal thing to want to be an astronaut. There were adult people who wanted to be astronauts up there.
They're not dressing up, but
they weren't dressing up, but they were serious. And there was a lot of astronauts who had gone to MIT. And so it almost made it a little bit almost normal, you know, trying to do that. And I started applying when I was in grad school and kept at it until they let me in.
What's the interview process like?
Well, it's changed a little bit over the years, but while I was going through it, it's still pretty much the same. They get a lot of applications, and now I've been on the other end where I look at the applications as they come in. But they get a few thousand applications from the public. They also get NASA gets applications from the military, so there's kind of like two sources. The military usually nominates their people. People apply to the military first, and then the military, the different services will forward the applications on to NASA. And then anyone, any civilian, can apply to the astronaut program. And then they sort through these thousands of applications, and there's some minimum requirements. So that's one cut. And then the next cut is to see who they want to get references on. And then you start getting into a group of maybe just a few hundred. And then they'll interview about 100 or so. And they bring you in groups. So back when I interviewed, they were bringing groups of 20. Six groups came in over a few months for 120 people to be interviewed for what happened to be 35 slots, 35 U.S. slots. It was a very large class that I was interviewed for.
Is it like a pledge class or something, like where you all sort of come in together?
When you come in together, you know, everyone's trying. You know, not everyone's going to make it. And it primarily for that week. You're there for a whole week. And most of the week is medical examinations, or it was when I went through it. And they've kind of broken that up now to like a first interview and a second interview, so it's a little bit different. But when I went through it, it was one whole week, and they tried to get everything done. And it was mainly medical tests. They checked you out from head to toe to make sure you were healthy and didn't have anything that they would be concerned about sending into space with. And the interview itself was 1 hour with a selection board that had about 15 people on it, including John Young, who had walked on the moon and was a first shuttle commander, and other different people from around the space program from different NASA centers. And there's always a few other astronauts on the board. And you just talk about yourself. You know, by that point, they figure you're probably qualified to do the job. And they just want to get to know you. You know, what is this person like? So the question they ask you, or they asked back then, it's not really super secret, but I'll let it out to the public now, was, you know, tell us about yourself since high school. And that was it. And you would start saying, well, I went to this college, and they would ask you why, or, you know, what did you do there? Why did you go into this field? And you would just continue on talking, just a way to get to know you. And if someone had an interest in something you had done, they might probe a little further. But it was really very friendly, trying to get you to relax and just to see what kind of person you were.
I have to ask about this, and you might just laugh at this, but in all the pictures I've ever seen of astronauts, particularly in space, everybody is just beaming.
Yeah,
and I know
happy.
That you're at this place that you've worked for years and years, but is there also something about, are they also looking for a particular temperament that is really optimistic and really able and willing to work in a team?
Yeah, that is true. But in space, it's a little, you know, it's a little bit biased because just about anybody is happy in space. Mm-hmm. You know, I know this is a PBS channel. You had was Oscar the Grouch.
Yeah.
He would be happy in space. Everyone would be happy. It's, I think that it's just, it just brings out the best in people when you're up there. It's a pretty fun place. But you do bring up a very valid point, is that, you know, it's not the smartest, necessarily the smartest person they're looking for. Obviously, in my case, I was that's the case. You know, I was never the smartest kid in the class.
You do have a PhD from MIT.
I do, but it was a lot of hard work. But I mean, they are looking for something a little bit more. It's not just who the smartest person is, who had the best grades or the highest SAT scores. They really don't care. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you have to have kind of a basic capability.
Yeah.
But really, what they're looking for are people that can work together and be part of a team, and that's. That's kind of hard to explain, but that's really what it is that they're looking for. Someone you can trust your life with, someone that's not going to take advantage of a situation for their own personal benefit, but someone that's going to be able to work together for a common good, let's say, and stand by you. You know, and I've got a quick story I can tell you
if you want,
just to give you an example.
It's NPR. We got an hour.
NPR, okay, good. All right, so on my most recent flight, up on STS-125 and went up to Hubble, we had to repair an instrument. It was my job, our team's job.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a point where I was repairing this one instrument I was trying to repair, and we had practiced for years to do this, and particularly me and my buddy, Drew Feustel, who was the astronaut inside, who was kind of reading me the checklist. He and I spent hours and hours staying after work, on the weekends, whatever we needed to do to get down this procedure because it was very complicated. We had 117 small screws we needed to remove from this instrument. It was very, very involved, and so on. So anyway, the point is it was a very difficult task that he and I worked a lot together. He was on the inside, and I was on the outside. Well, I ended up stripping a bolt, for example, and it was what happened on this mission while I was out there, and I could not remove this handle. You might have seen
the IMAX movie, the Smithsonian.
So I could not get this handle off, and I was probably the lowest I ever was in my life. I felt horrible that this was going on while I was spacewalking.
And you can't just throw something against the side of the
shuttle. No, I mean, we don't have that much time. It's terrible. We could not get this handrail removed. It was a bolt that was stripped, and we ended up coming up with a solution, which you see in the movie, was just to rip the thing off. But while this process of troubleshooting was going on, I was feeling horrible, and I had to go back to the front of the shuttle to fetch some tools. And right at the front of the shuttle, there's windows looking down so they can see what we're doing in the payload bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that my friend, who I'd been working with these years, was right there looking down on me. I didn't even want to look at him because I was so depressed over what had happened. I felt like I had sabotaged the future of astronomy single-handedly. They would not have me speaking at the colloquium today. And I wouldn't be sitting here if we couldn't get this thing fixed. I felt terrible about it then. But I remember I finally got enough nerve to look up into the cabin and look at my buddy. And he's looking, smiling at me and giving me okay signs and thumbs up. And we really couldn't say anything because we had a hot microphone. But he was mouthing to me, "We're going to be fine. We're going to be okay." And I was telling him, I was trying to mouth him, "Are you not watching what's going on?" But the point being is that that was a point where I really needed a friend. You know, I didn't need someone to say, "You jerk, look what you did." I needed someone who was going to help me out and get me through this tough situation. What he did for me.
I want to say there's a picture of that in that they sent us this, I guess folks from NASA sent us this cool book about the mission, and you sort of see that in there. And we don't really see you because you've got your helmet on outside the thing. And anyway, no one can see it, and it'll take me a while to find it.
Yeah.
But it was a great image. Are you always thinking about the fact that, this is history, that you're, you know, working with the world's most famous telescope and you don't want to, you know, drop something into it?
Yeah, no, that's a big deal. There's a bit stressful. And during the training, you think about that as well, that any little false move, generating debris, if you scratch yourself or sneeze at the wrong time and throw your hands up and crash into something while you're inside of the telescope particularly, it could be a problem. And so, yeah, it's a bit of a responsibility because you want to do the best you can for the instrument so that the scientists can get their information and so that people can enjoy the beauty of space, get the information we need from the telescope, and have nice wall calendars because it gets some great pictures out of it. And the information that comes from the telescope is amazing and very important. And so we're given the responsibility to be in direct line to either help that legacy continue or to totally destroy it one false move. So it's a bit stressful, and it makes you really pay attention to what you're doing. And again, the teamwork part of it that you mentioned is utmost, because that's the only way you can succeed.
How do the people who train you help you to walk the line between understanding how very critical every tiny little move is and allowing you to have the confidence to not be afraid to touch anything at all?
It is the training that does it. And, the thought of going out and doing a spacewalk, particularly a complicated one with, high risk and high risk maybe to yourself, maybe not necessarily yourself, but also put it to the telescope, let's say, mm-hmm. That would be pretty daunting just to think about doing that. And the only way to get around that is to train. And so what they do is you train and train and train. You have different facilities where you train a lot underwater in our spacesuits to get down the choreography and working together and working with our tools in the spacesuits. It's very similar to what we experience in space. But we also have lots of other facilities where we can work, like on the repair I talked about, repairing an instrument. We had a special mock-up of that instrument where I could practice with my tools in a short sleeve environment in my office. Mm-hmm. I could practice over and over again and break stuff and make mistakes. And really what we're doing in training is we're trying to make as many mistakes as we can so we can check off. I think there's like a list somewhere of all the mistakes you can make, all the things you can screw up. And in training, you want to check those off as much as you can. Try different things. Do your best always, but learn from what you do. See what you've screwed up and try to learn from it so that mistake doesn't happen again. And that's the way we do is we just work as much as we can, practice as much as we can, and then you try to think creatively, like what could go wrong? What can I do to screw up? What are my danger zones? What is the thing that can go wrong here that I need to be careful of? So you almost have to think negatively in some ways of where could the problems reside and then trying to think of what you would do to solve those. Because once you get to space, you've only got a finite amount of time to get the job done.
Is it possible, even with all the training and the simulations and the photographs you've seen and the video, to know how you're going to feel when you're finally out there in orbit?
No. I mean, and that's what I thought about, particularly for my first flight. What am I going to be able to blink my eyes and move around, or what am I going to feel like? And I was very pleased to find out that I felt fine, mm-hmm. And I think what you can try to anticipate as much as you can. The thing that really impressed me the most, I think impresses just about everyone, is just the beauty that surrounds you, the beauty of the Earth and the stars, of what you get to see out there mm-hmm. Through the window of the space shuttle or whatever spaceship you're on or the space station. And also through your helmet, especially when you're spacewalking. Is just beautiful, and there's nothing that can prepare you for that. It is just so overwhelming to physically see that stuff. There's nothing that can prepare you, but to prepare you for your work and to get your job done, we're very well prepared to do that.
My guest this hour is U.S. astronaut Mike Massimino. He took space flights in 2002 and 2009 to service the Hubble Space Telescope. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astronaut Mike Massimino. He went on space flights in 2002 and 2009 and serviced the Hubble Space Telescope. Join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, I want to ask you a question about Hubble that you will probably roll your eyes at, but
nope.
I've seen the images. They're extraordinary, and if someone explains them to me, I can understand them.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 350 miles above
That's correct.
The surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
Given the extraordinary distance of space, why does that 350 miles make such a difference?
No, I think it's an excellent question, because that's why Hubble is so effective, is because it can get up that high, and it's above our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy I'll make is if you're at the in a swimming pool, say like 6-foot swimming pool at the bottom, looking up at the sun through the water, it would be kind of cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get out of the water and you look up at the sun and it's clear, right? That's kind of what the atmosphere does to us when we look at the stars. It's kind of like you're looking at the sun through the bottom of a pool.
Mm-hmm.
It's very it clouds what we can see. And so once you get above that atmosphere and you don't have any of the effects of the thickness of the atmosphere, even though it's relatively very thin compared mm-hmm. to the size of the Earth, you get above that, you don't have any distortion, and you can see objects very, very clearly. Even with your eye, with the naked eye, looking out the window of the space shuttle or through your space helmet while you're spacewalking, when you look at the stars, there's no twinkle, twinkle, little star. It's no twinkling. They're like these perfect points of light, because the atmosphere gives us that little bit of twinkle that we see when we look at the stars at night, even on a clear night in a very dark area, some remote area. But so that's what the telescope can do for us. Since it's above that atmosphere, it has nothing in its way to see what is out there.
So after the Hubble finishes its service in, everyone's hoping, 2014 or beyond.
We don't warranty our work, by the way, Chris. There's no warranty on labor.
Well, if all goes as expected. Then there's the James Webb Telescope.
Yes, that's going to be the follow-on.
And how's that different?
That's going to be a little further out than where the Hubble is. It's not going to be serviceable by a spacecraft that we know of yet, unless we come up with something and go service it. So it's not meant to be serviced. So Hubble was meant to be serviced so you could keep updating his technology. In fact, if you remember, Hubble had a problem when it first launched that they were able to fix, because we had these
servicing
issues.
The lens was ground wrong or something?
Yes, it was an aberration in the lens of the telescope that they were able to fix very cleverly on a subsequent mission. So that's going to be out on its own. But it's going to be a more powerful telescope. It's going to be even further away from Earth. So it won't be orbiting at the same way the Hubble does. So it'll be able to get longer exposures of what it's looking at and be more powerful with new technology. So I don't know what the latest time frame is on that telescope, but hopefully it won't be too much longer till they get that one ready to go.
How different is one space shuttle from the next? Is it like, the fleet vehicle at the company and everybody wants a certain one?
No, they're all about the same. There were some differences, some minor ones. Columbia, which we lost, of course. Mm-hmm. My first space flight was on Columbia.
The last successful mission.
Yeah, we were the last ones to land with Columbia. The mission following ours was STS-107, which we lost Columbia. But Columbia had an internal airlock, which meant its airlock was kind of inside the shuttle as opposed to being outside in the payload bay. So it was a little bit smaller inside. It didn't have as much room. But other than that, there wasn't really much difference between them. And you learn how to operate on one, you can operate on any of them. So they're identical, really, from one to the other.
Did being on that last mission to land Columbia, did that fact sort of make it even more traumatic for you than losing friends and colleagues in the explosion?
The whole thing was just a nightmare for anyone who was involved at that time, I think. And, we were actually STS-109, and they were STS-107. So we were actually supposed to go after them, mm-hmm. after that crew on Columbia. When Columbia was out at the shop out in Palmdale, California, it came back to the Kennedy Space Center. The space shuttles get refurbished every few years. And when it came back from its overhaul after it had flown a bunch, it had a bad – something's wrong with its paint. It had a bad paint job or something, and they needed to redo some stuff on Columbia. And they didn't want to delay us any longer to go to Hubble. They were concerned about the health of the telescope. So they actually flipped us with the 107 crew. So we went in their place and they went in ours.
Hmm.
So we got their tank and they got ours. And so that, made you think that, who knows what would have happened if the order of flights would have stayed the same. but it was something that went through my mind. And don't talk about it. I'm talking about with you and your viewers yeah. right now, but we don't talk about that too much. But I think being on Columbia and then losing the ship, it gave you a little bit of a different feeling. After the accident, the debris was being sorted through and on display as it came in. And it must have been maybe about 3 months after the accident as this debris was coming in, being assembled at the Kennedy Space Center. I went down with the pilot on my first flight, Dwayne Carey, who was a good friend of mine. He's no longer in the astronaut office, but at the time, you know, we were astronauts together. And we flew down to the Kennedy Space Center together one afternoon to look at the wreckage. And I think it's a little bit different when you see it, what happened to the ship, and you see the different pieces of it here and there. And knowing you were on that ship and then see it out there on the floor in a zillion pieces, it had a different effect on me, I think, than it would have if I'd never been on that space shuttle. But the overall impression of it, the whole thing, was just losing your friends that way was pretty devastating.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Miguel on the line in Dallas. Hey, Miguel.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
I had a question. First of all, thank you for the wonderful work you do and for allowing us the beautiful sights that we get to see through the work that you guys and NASA do. My question, I wanted to know, out of your class, what percentage of people graduated and how many actually get to go to the moon and do spacewalks?
Well, none of us got to go to the moon. We are shuttle astronauts, and we haven't been to the moon in quite a while, since 1972, and only 12 people have had the chance to walk on the moon back then. So we don't get to go to the moon, but we do get to go on the shuttle. And every one of us got through the program, but not everyone had a chance to fly. We had some folks come down with medical conditions that weren't life-threatening, but were bad enough to keep them from flying. We did lose one person, natural causes, before he could fly, who unfortunately passed away. And we had a three of my classmates were on the Columbia. But just about everybody gets through the training program, if that's what your question is. And then unless a medical thing pops up, then most people get a chance to fly in space. And then the spacewalk thing is a bit of luck involved with that. Our pilot astronauts on the shuttle program are trained to fly the shuttle and don't necessarily train to do spacewalks. But the mission specialists do, which is your scientists and engineers and so on. So that's one thing that kind of distinguishes you as a mission specialist. You have the better of an opportunity to do a spacewalk. And then it depends on what the mission is about and what's appropriate for that mission or what your job will be. But a lot of us have, just about every one of us got a chance to go in space, and a lot of us have gotten a chance to spacewalk.
How far is the shuttle from the telescope when you're going from one to the other?
It's in the payload bay. What we do is we rendezvous with it on our third day in space. We launch, we have a day to get ready, and then we rendezvous with it and grab it with the robot arm, mm-hmm. and then we put it in our payload bay. We have a servicing structure, which is at the back of the space shuttle payload bay, kind of like a turntable, a lazy Susan that rotates, so you can point the correct part of the telescope you want to work on forward so you can have easy access to it. Mm-hmm. So we grab it with the robot arm, we put it down on this turntable, and it gets latched down, and then we release the robot arm. So now it's nice and fixed. And we also have an power umbilical to it that we can power it while it's in our payload bay. So it's right there. It's kind of like the playground outside of the school. You don't have to go that far to get to it to do our work. It's right out there.
But while you're out there, I guess you don't really feel it, but you're orbiting the Earth at like incredible speed.
17,500 miles an hour is yeah. your speed. Yeah.
So times coast 8 hours, which is your longest flight, is how long?
I'm sorry. 8 hours was my longest.
So 17,000 times 8 hours is like
how many miles did we go?
Yeah.
I didn't know there was going to be math here, Chris. What are you saying? That's a lot. That's a lot of miles. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. But you don't. It doesn't feel that way because there's no wind and no debris.
No, but it's you're going fast. I was looking out the window of the shuttle one time, and my watch was on my wrist, and I hit the little the timer when we hit Baja California, mm-hmm. and then we hit Miami, and I clicked in. It was 11 minutes coast to coast. So you're moving really quickly, and you see, you have a lot of sunrises and sunsets. Mm-hmm. It takes 90 minutes to do one lap of the Earth, and it's every 45 minutes you get a sunrise or a sunset. So you get 18 sunrises and sunsets in a 24-hour period, And when you're out there in space, it's a big event, you know, especially when you spacewalk, and it's mm-hmm. you can kind of feel it coming, because in the darkness it could be as cold as a couple hundred degrees below zero,
mm-hmm.
and in the bright sunlight it could be as hot as, if you had a thermometer out there, it could go as hot as a couple hundred degrees above zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the brightness of the sun is the brightest white I've ever experienced. It's almost like a purity to it. It's like this pure whiteness when you're out there in the sunlight. And then when you hit over in the dark side of the Earth, where it's nighttime, I guess in China right now, the opposite side from where it's nice and bright out here in Dallas, it becomes the darkest dark I've ever experienced. It's like the void of light. There's no light at all. And this change is happening every 45 minutes. And you can almost feel it coming. Like you can, it's kind of like if you're in the ocean, Gulf of Mexico is, I guess, the closest thing we've got here, you know, and you feel all of a sudden like a cold current will come. You kind of feel that kind of down in your bones.
Suddenly
almost.
You're in cold water. Yeah.
You're warm. All of a sudden you get that little cold streak you might walk into in the ocean. That's kind of the way it is. You're comfortable, and all of a sudden you can kind of feel a coldness come over kind of deep down in your body, and you'll look, and sure enough, you'll see the line between dark and light, and you can see the Earth rotate about that line. You can see the line right there. You know, it's kind of cool, because so here I am looking down at the Earth, and here it's sunlight, and here it's darkness, and there's the, you know, as the Earth is rotating, where the, you know, sun is rising or setting, and he's like, all right, sunrise in California. It's dark right now, but now it's bright as you're zipping around. So, yeah, you're going very, very quickly, and it's just so mind-boggling. I think the any sensation of speed you don't have, it's just an awesome sight that you, you know, it just kind of blows your mind when you're looking at it.
And there's no time built in for, excuse the expression, for you to stare off into space while you're out there.
Not always, but you get moments. My first flight, I had an opportunity while I was spacewalking to stare. You can see it through the windows as well, the shuttle, but it's a different experience because your view is limited by the windows of the spaceship.
Are they like scratched up and stuff?
They are. It's still beautiful. They are actually scratched up, mm-hmm. you know, and but it's still a beautiful view. But when you get outside in the spacewalk, you can see the whole Earth in its entirety from the Hubble altitude. The Earth takes up your view. You can see that in the IMAX movie where it's big, but you can see the curvature of it. You can see what it looks like there in front of you. But your question was, sorry.
Staring off into space.
Staring off into space. Yeah, see, I get distracted easily, as you can find. but I had a real treat on my last spacewalk, the second one of my second flight. I got done a little bit early, and my spacewalking partner still had some stuff to do, and my commander said, and I was by the airlock, and he said, Mass, he goes, you know, you've got a little bit of time here. Why don't you just take a break and enjoy the view? And I just hooked in my tether and just stared. And we were coming over Hawaii, over the Pacific, and it was daylight. And we came over the U.S. We hit California, and I was just staring and enjoying it the whole time. And then over the East Coast, and we were coming over the Atlantic, and it just started to get dark. And just as we went into night, it was time for me to come inside. But I had about 25 minutes just to enjoy what I was looking at. And so you do have moments where you can just enjoy it, thank goodness. And those are the ones you remember the most.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jeff in Plano. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Matt, Mastodon. Huh? That's great. How's it going, Mike?
Doing well, Jeff.
I love your videos shot in HD or on NASA TV of the astronauts and training and the flight controllers. It cracks me up. You know all the answers yet. You asked the good questions for the listeners.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
I have a question for you about the shape of the universe. When we look one direction, now with Hubble, we can look in one direction, and 13.7 billion light years away, we see a galaxy there. And we look the opposite direction, we'll see one there probably. And that means those galaxies are separated at that point by about, you know, whatever the math is, you know, 26, 27 billion light years. Yet when we're looking at them, when we see them, they're back in time, those galaxies were much closer together, like maybe, I don't know, 300,000 or 400,000 light years apart. How do you explain the fact that the farther you look, the farther back in time you're looking, and you're looking really at the most distant objects in the universe that were very close together? To me, it's a bizarre kind of shape question, and I don't know if people have grappled with that or not.
I don't know. I tell you what, Jeff, I wish I could. My friend who's my host here, Wolfgang Rindler, would probably be a lot better off. He's an astronomer to answer that question. But you know, what you're saying is true. I'm really not sure how to explain it, but it is interesting. Hubble is kind of like a time machine. it's looking back, the light travels and reaches Earth. So if something is, billions of light years away, it's took that long for that light to reach us. You know, and Hubble's not that far away from the Earth, only 350 miles. So it's that's the time it's taken to reach Earth. So that we're seeing stuff, the light we're seeing actually emanated from that object many, many years ago. And so it's kind of like we're looking at a time capsule of what is out there, what the universe was like at that time. And as we get further and further away, as we can see further and further away from where we are now, we're seeing further and further back into the past, to the origins of the universe. And I don't know if we really know what the whole shape is like and how it all behaves. I know that Hubble has done some interesting things, not only answered questions that people had, like, are there galaxies in dark parts of the sky? And it's found that, yes, we couldn't see them with our telescopes but on the ground, but Hubble has found them. It answered the question whether or not there were black holes. People thought there were. Hubble proved that there were. And people thought there would be planets in other solar systems, and Hubble has shown that there are. But I find what's more interesting is what Hubble has come up with as far as questions that we don't have the answers to. Like, we knew that the universe was expanding, but what Hubble found was that it's expanding at an accelerating rate. So it's as if you took a baseball and threw it up in the air, and not only does it come back down to Earth, it keeps going, but it speeds up as it gets further away. And that's kind of what's going on with the universe. So I don't know if we know exactly the answer to Jeff's question, exactly what the shape is like, but we do know that Hubble's looking further back into our past as it looks further into the universe.
My guest this hour is astronaut Mike Massimino. He took space flights in 2002 and 2009 to service the Hubble Space Telescope. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. Astronaut Mike Massimino is my guest. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I want to ask you something I've always been curious about. I know that you don't spend the night before you go on a mission at home, right? You're in this special place.
Yes.
Is it impossible to sleep?
No. It's surreal, though, that whole experience. So, and the special place we go to that you referred to is called Astronaut Crew Quarters. Mm-hmm. And about a week before the flight, in fact, 1 week before the flight, they put you into a quarantine situation, which is they don't want you to get sick.
So you're not picking up the flu somewhere.
Exactly. So you go into this health stabilization program, they call it. So anyone that comes into contact with you, whether it's a family member who comes to visit or an instructor that you're going to go over some stuff with to get ready, or a flight director or whoever, has to be checked out by the doc and sure that they're not sick or carrying any germs, because you don't want to get anybody sick. So a week before, we go into the quarantine. And, of course, we get sick while we're in quarantine. Inevitably, I got a cold both of my times. But they're trying to keep you healthy, and so you're not sleeping at home. It's kind of strange. I know my first flight, I went to bed that night, and very excited about flying in space, the next day. And I was very glad when I woke up and didn't run for it. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, I stayed there. I didn't run scared. I mm-hmm. stayed. And I got up and I was getting ready to go. And you go, you have breakfast and you come in and you put your fancy clothes on. You're going to put your fancy underwear on, a cooling garment underwear, like kind of like long underwear with tubes through it. And you put on your space suit and you're going to walk out.
The orange
spaceship.
Uniform that we all
the
know.
The big orange space suit. You're going to have a nice breakfast and do all that. So the first thing, of course, I did when I woke up before I did any of that ceremonial stuff is I called my wife. So I called my wife and I said, Carol, I'm very excited. I'm getting ready to go. She goes, no one told you? I go, what? She goes, you're not going anywhere today. I go, you know, stop messing around. There's no time for jokes. She goes, no, you're not going there. I go, really? I go, what happened? She goes, well, the temperature dropped last night, and they decided they weren't going to, you weren't going to launch. And I go, when did they figure this out? It was like, it's like a half hour after we went to bed or something. They made this. So we went to bed thinking we were going to launch. So I wonder if the only guy that, you know, didn't know this. You know, I think I'm going to go. My wife has to tell me I'm not going into space. You know, I got to find everything.
There could be a better system with NASA, right?
What the heck? So I'm like, so I go and I look, and I, my commander, Scott Altman, a good friend of mine, is in our little, we have like a little conference room area that they have for us over there in quarantine. And he's sitting there in his boxer shorts. Maybe that's too much information. But he's sitting there with this dumbfounded look on his face. And I go, screw, did you hear what happened? He goes, yeah. I go, you know, I'm thinking he's the commander. Surely they couldn't cancel the space flight without telling the commander. I was just a rookie. Who cares? You know, mm-hmm. I'm just along for the ride. So he goes, when did you find out? And he goes, about 5 minutes ago from Newman. I go, how'd he find out? He goes, his wife told him. So his, this is how we find, our wives had to tell us that we weren't going. That was my first experience. But I found I was just very excited. But, you know, it's almost, it's almost normal when you're in crew quarters. You know, you're going through this one day, you know, you think about it when you're going to bed. You know, next time I go to sleep and I wake up, I'll be in space. You know, it's kind of weird, but it actually does happen. You know, you actually get up and go, and the next time you are going to bed, you're in space. And there's also the anticipation to find, you know, I wonder what's going to happen. You know, are we going to launch? Are we going to be okay? Is it all going to go well? You know, I'll know. You know, you've gone through these years of training where you're waiting for that day to come, and it's elusive, you know, it moves, you get mm-hmm. delays. Ours was delayed a few times, and then finally you've made it to that night before, as you describe, and I don't know, I didn't have trouble sleeping, but I was pretty excited.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Bob in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I just have a rather mundane question. And that is, how do you keep the visor on the space helmet from fogging up on the inside?
It's a good question, Bob. And it's a problem because you are breathing. The visor is right in front of your face, so it will fog. What we do is we put an anti-fog on it. It's a liquid detergent soap that they don't even manufacture anymore except for us. I think we have the big stash of it left over because now the soaps have changed in their composition. But it's a detergent soap that we apply to the inside. It comes in. It's packaged in little packages on some kind of debris-free type mm-hmm. of paper, so we can apply it without getting any dust or anything on the visor. But we apply that anti-fog on there, onto the inside of the visor, and then we buff it. And then we put it on our heads and make sure it works. You kind of like breathe to give the kind of like you would in the winter on a window. You can't really do that here in Dallas. Doesn't get that. I guess it gets cold here once it's colder than Houston.
It does.
So you know you kind of fog it up and see if it works, and it works pretty well. So we apply the antifog, and it's kind of like a little ceremony that we do the night before your spacewalk, before you go to bed, after everything is ready. You grab your space helmet and your little antifog dispenser. And you and your buddy go up to the flight deck and look out the window and apply the anti-fog to the helmet and buff it down so you won't fog up. But it's an excellent question because it would really cause trouble. And in fact, on one of the first spacewalks, one of the very first spacewalks that we ever did back on the Gemini program when he started doing this, that they found out that you can, when you get overheated or you're working hard, you will breathe heavy and you will fog up your visor. Mm-hmm. And then you can't see where you're going, and that's bad. So you need to be able to see where you're going when you're spacewalking. So the anti-fog helps us.
And are you able to at least drink something while you're out there for hours and hours?
We have a drink bag. We have a 32-ounce drink bag. It's kind of like a camelback, you know, that you would wear when you're hiking. Mm-hmm. It's special designed for us. It sits in the front part of our suit. That's our other ritual that we do beside the anti-fog is you fill up your drink bag with water and get all the air bubbles out of it. And we have a little straw that we can access it. They tried food years mm-hmm. ago, and it just made a mess. We're very messy eaters. It didn't work. They had a food bar, and that just made a tremendous mess because stuff floats around in there, and it's terrible. So you want to have a good breakfast. Very, very important. Because you're out, you might be spacewalking. You plan for 6.5 hours for a spacewalk. Sometimes, like in my case, because I'm very slow, it took us over 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And then you're in the suit, though. You're locked inside of that thing for a pre-breathe, and by the time you get inside, it's like 10 hours that you're inside of there without any food. So you want to make sure you eat well and get a good breakfast beforehand, and then you have your drink back to keep yourself hydrated.
Is the food in space better than that god-awful astronaut ice cream that my kids always want to buy when we visit?
The reason it's available for your kids to buy uh-huh. is because we will not eat it. That stuff is terrible. I don't want to hurt their sales or anything, but, man, that's a nice souvenir, but I don't want to eat. No, we have really good food. Mm-hmm. We have it comes in different forms. It's just packaged differently. We have dehydrated food where we add water. Some of those items that I enjoy that are dehydrated are macaroni and cheese, shrimp cocktail, Chinese
dehydrated
food.
Dehydrated shrimp cocktail.
Oh, it's good stuff. Uh-huh. It's really good. And it's easy to cook. Mm-hmm. You don't need ingredients. It comes all ready to go. Just add water mm-hmm. and warm it up. We have an oven so you can warm things up. Takes a few minutes. We have meals ready to eat from the military that are pretty good. Lasagna, ravioli. I have an Italian background, so mm-hmm. I go for that stuff. But it's really good. And our desserts are way better than an ice cream. We got brownies and chocolate fudge cake and cookies and candy and really good stuff. So the food is great.
Speaking of your background, I know that you're from Long Island and you're mm-hmm. a Mets fan.
Yes.
And you took from the old Shea Stadium, which
right.
I grew up in Long Island, so I spent a
did
lot
you?
Of time there
All
with
right.
my dad as a kid.
Nice.
You took home plate with you up into space?
I did. You see, because Shea, I know we're in Texas Rangers territory here, baseball-wise. But, yeah, I'm from New York, and so my team growing up, as you said, was the Mets. And both New York teams, the Yankees and the Mets, got new stadiums the same year. It was in 2009. Yeah, it was, mm-hmm. there was any, 2008 was the last year for the stadiums, and in 2009. And my friend, my good friend, Garrett Reisman, who's a Yankee fan from New Jersey, took dirt from the Yankee Stadium mm-hmm. and flew it in space in honor of Yankee Stadium. So I called up my friends with the Mets, and I said, "You hear about this guy, my friend from New Jersey with the dirt?" He goes, "Yeah, Mike, we could do better than dirt." And so they sent me a home plate mm-hmm. from Shea Stadium. It became a bit of an engineering project how to fit this thing inside of the space shuttle.
And they're kind of heavy, right?
They're a bit heavy. Yeah, they're a bit heavy. But it was more the shape of it which was a problem. In fact, we looked up the dimensions. This became a real project for us at NASA, for me and my crewmates, because we're all baseball fans. We looked at the dimensions of a home plate, and I think it was like 17 and a half inches by 17 and a half inches or from the head to toe, whatever it was, on the plate. But that was just a white part of the plate. So we made a little mock-up, and mm-hmm. it fit fine in the locker. So I told the Mets, yeah, send the plate along. What I didn't account for was a little black strip of rubber that goes around the white plate.
To hold it in place.
To hold
right?
it in yeah. place. And that thing gave us an extra inch on each side. It wouldn't fit inside of the locker. So what I did was, again, with one of my smart astronaut friends, we figured out a way to remove the black rubber from the white part of the plate, and we just flew the white part of the plate, and then we glued back the black part of the plate before I gave it back to the Mets. So the black strip around it didn't go in space. It was just the main white part of the plate.
And they didn't just throw it back into the diamond and use it again after that, did they?
No, I don't think so. I thought it would help them score some runs, but that didn't work either. No, they have it on display. They have the museum there in their new stadium, and they have it on display in the new stadium. So.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will go to Greenville and speak with Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi, and Doctor, thanks for everything you've done. I have kind of perhaps an odd question. You know, we always hear about landmarks or things that you can, quote, see from space, and I know you can see big cities and the lights and that kind of thing, but I was curious, what's the smallest thing on Earth that you can clearly identify as being what it is from space, whether it's, you know, a building, probably not a building, certainly not home plate at where the Mets play, but... What's the smallest thing you can see and really know that's exactly what it is? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
I think it really depends on the altitude you're at. For me, in our flight, when we're at the higher altitude, when we're up with Hubble with the telescope, it's very hard to see detail. You can see a lot of the Earth, but you can't see the detail. And we were at lower altitudes toward the end of our flight. We adjusted our altitude to about 250 miles. And at that point, you can make out more detail. I would guess for me, you can easily see a volcano or the smallest distinguishable thing was like airports. You can kind of make out where an airport would be, mm-hmm. A big runway, let's say, and it's in a clear area. You can kind of make out where that would be from space.
Let's go back to the phones one more time. This time we will speak with Joe in Dallas. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Chris. I love your program.
Thanks.
Question what does outer space smell like?
Oh, that's a good question. We really don't know because if we were going to be, the inside of the space shuttle kind of smells like people after 2 weeks together. So it's like being on a camping trip. Although we do practice good hygiene, you know, we smell like people. But the question is, what I'm going to answer it anyway, is what like space actually smells like. And we really can't do that because if space is in a vacuum, and if we remove our helmet so that our nose could get access to what it smells like, we wouldn't last very long. Mm-hmm. But the reason I like your question is that when we do our spacewalks, after the spacewalk is over and we repress the airlock, and get ready to take the, you know, the guys or gals out of the airlock, go in there, you open up the hatch from the shuttle, you open up the hatch, and there is this very distinct smell. And it's only smelled in the airlock after a spacewalk, and it's the same on any spaceship. You know, the Russians have said it's the same, you know, in their ships years ago. It's the same on the space station. There's always this very, very distinct odor, and it's a very metallic smell. That is a couple theories for that. I think if you were looking for a reason why it smells like that, it could be just because everything outgasses. You have lots of tools, a lot of metal tools. Yeah. You have your spacesuit. The airlock itself is made of metal. And under low pressure, things will outgas. You know, the pressure that we have around us, our one atmosphere working around at sea level, kind of keeps things stable and keeps the odor in, you know, doesn't gases, metals won't outgas. But in space, when they are exposed to the vacuum, that outgassing occurs. So I think it could be, if you're looking for a real reason of what that could be, and it's probably, I would say maybe, in my opinion, likely that it's just the outgassing of the metals in the airlock and the tools. But, you know, the people like to think that that's what space actually smells like. But I can tell you that is, once you open the airlock, you know, after a spacewalk and you reopen the airlock, it's that very distinct odor. It doesn't last very long, just, you know, maybe a few minutes. But it's definitely there, very distinct metallic odor. So that's, I think, the closest we've come to what it actually smells like out there.
So the shuttle program is about at an end. Yeah. Will you have a chance to fly again?
The opportunity is there, and I've flown twice on the shuttle. And if I'm going to fly again in the next couple of years, it would be on the Russian Soyuz up to the space station. And I think I would like to do that. Mm-hmm. And my kids are teenagers in high school, so I'm trying to stay around as much as I can on Earth for the next couple of years. But maybe in a couple of years, that opportunity might still be there.
When you first get back and you're back in, like, the carpool line and you know, picking up eggs on the way home, is it just a huge letdown?
Well, it's, you know, it's different. I mean, when you it is a bit, but it's also, you're very grateful to be back in some ways.
Yeah.
And I was really happy. You know, the mission's going to end anyway, so it might as well end successfully is what I figure, you know. So I was very happy not only to get back and everyone be healthy and with a good spaceship back on Earth, but also with the mission well done. I was really grateful that we were able to get everything done. We were very fortunate with all the little problems we had that we were able to leave the telescope in better condition than when we found it, and I was very happy that we were successful. At the same time, it's, you know, when you're training for a space flight, you have a really good excuse not to have to mow the lawn. And then when you get back, you know, those excuses now have turned into, you know, you haven't mowed the lawn or made lunches for like 2 years. It's time. So
you got to pay back.
Yep.
Astronaut Mike Massimino has been part of space missions on Shuttle Columbia in 2002 and Atlantis in 2009. Mike, it was such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure, and really appreciate you having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.